With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern, and I am joined by Heidi White and Adam Andrews. Heidi, Adam, welcome back.
Thanks,
David. Good to be back.
So we are here to answer listener questions about Ralph Moody's book, Little Bridges, which, of course, we've been talking about over the last, seven, 8 weeks. So we're going to get to that in just a second. Don't forget about all the great content going on. We have Macbeth, Act 4 going up, I believe, today. Today's Friday, May 17th. That should be up today sometime. Logan's working on that now, making it listenable. So that'll be up soon. We have The Daily Poem. We have Libromania. We have lots of great content for you. So if you are, you know, in the mood, check it out. Let us know if you like it. Starred reviews, subscriptions, comment reviews, all that stuff goes a long way. We'd appreciate that. And we want to let you know about our friends over at Classical Academic Press, because if you are a busy school or homeschool educator who is enthused about the classical tradition of education, maybe you wish you had been classically trained yourself. Well, they created Classical U with you in mind. And they are confident that this is a resource that will inspire educators in schools, homeschools, and co-ops to dig deep, deep, deep into the richness of learning, no matter where you find yourself on your journey in classical education. Discover over 35 self-paced courses, new content regularly added, community, forums, and recently added accreditation through ACSI. That's a pretty big deal. So if you want to check this out, you can begin your journey at www.classicalu.com. That is the letter U. It's called classicalu.com. And if you are a Close Reads listener, which in theory you are, if you are listening to the show, maybe not even in theory, literally.
No, it's actual.
Yeah. Then you can head over to classicalu.com/code and enter the code Circe Podcast at checkout. And that will get you free access to Classical U through June 29th. And again, that's classicalu.com/code. Don't forget that slash code in there, because I think some people were having some trouble at figuring out where to go. So again, it's classicalu.com/code. And the code itself is Circe Podcast, all one word, all lowercase. So CIRCEPODCAST. And again, that's free access to Classical U through June 29th. All right. Well, we are going to answer questions from literal Close Reads listeners now. And we have a couple different threads here on the Close Reads Facebook group, which of course you could join if you want to join the conversation on this book. And we talked a lot about, in this conversation over the last few weeks in particular, about the note at the end, that it, you know, the afterword that is in some editions. And Sarah asks, can you please, she didn't actually ask a question, she made a statement. Please, she made a demand. Please discuss, please discuss further whether this afterword detracts from the quality of the book. Also, do all of Moody's books have a moral message? Would you say that Laura Ingalls Wilder writes with a message? Please compare and contrast Moody and Wilder's writing. So there's a couple different things going on there. But let's talk about this idea of whether it detracts from the quality of the book. We touched on it a little bit, but let's assume we need to dive in on it again. So Adam, I'm going to turn to you first on this one. Would you say that it detracts from the quality of the book at all, or is it, you know, it might theoretically detract from a reader's experience who has read the afterword?
That's a good question, because the afterword is another it's another self-conscious statement from the author about his book. I mean, I think I might have touched on this last time, and my perspective on literary theory is that self-conscious statements from the author about the purpose and nature of the book are to be respected and hold, you know, carry a lot of weight.
Sure. Yeah.
So, I would definitely say that the author's afterword, should color what we think about his goal, about what he meant.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things I was trying to allude to at the end last time before I had to leave, if I remember right, is that the way that he went about making his point touched on some universal themes. Yeah. And indeed, I think he would have agreed that he was trying to touch on universal themes. One of the reasons he's so, adamant about making the point that he was making is because he thought it was universal, right? He thought it was significant. But I think that the fact that his story touches on universal themes, even in the process of making a culturally bounded point, gives the story significance beyond that point. Mm. Because it, just to use the details of the story, he wants to give young boys a brush with the kind of young boyhood that he thinks is good for America in the 1950s. Mm. And in the process, describes boyhood in ways that make our hearts leap, and describes a relationship between a boy and his father that has nothing to do with the 1950s or the 1890s or any time and place, because it's a universal relationship. And I think the book has value in the way that it turns our hearts and our minds toward that universal relationship, completely apart from whether we use it as a didactic tool to raise our own children. Mm.
Heidi, do you think it detracts from the quality of the book? I mean, I think Adam's point, you know, he makes a distinction there that we certainly need to, I mean, maybe I'm making the distinction that he wasn't making actually, but you, Adam, you were saying that we need to at least be aware of it, and we need to take it into account, and we need to listen to what he's trying to say about his own work. But that doesn't, but taking it into account doesn't necessarily, I mean, could still in theory make, it could take away from the book. So, Heidi, I mean, what do you think about that?
I don't think it detracts from the book, but I'm glad it was an afterword and not a foreword.
That's interesting.
I think that when you read the purpose of this is what I want my book to mean to you, I think that could potentially detract from it if you read it that way.
You mean like it was an afterword. You need to have the experience of reading it first, then you could read that, and then that leads into study of the book.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily mean that to be a hard and fast universal statement, but specifically in Little Britches, the content of that afterword, I think, worked as an afterword rather than a foreword. I think if that had been, and to be honest, because it's a children's book, it wasn't surprising. Like there is no sense of, oh my goodness, that's what you're trying to do? Like seems like it was really clear throughout the book. And it worked. What I like about it being an afterword is that you're already invested in this man's life and his journey and his childhood. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you're emotionally caught up in kind of the glory and the sadness of his life. And so by the time you get to the afterword and you see he intended this to have kind of a more widespread impact, and I think that really worked. I thought it was lovely, and I thought it added to the book. But mm-hmm. I don't like to be told by an author before I read something what he or she wants me to get out of it. I think you should let the book speak for itself at that point in general, you know, probably with some exceptions. But I like that this was an afterword. And I also agree with Adam that if there is something else, we're not bound necessarily by what the author stated intention is to only find that in the book. You know, and I know I've mentioned this before with A Christmas Carol, Dickens said, I wanted this to produce social change. And it didn't really work like that. It ended up being, for almost everybody, an insight into the human condition through Scrooge. But that wasn't necessarily Dickens' stated purpose. Mm. But it works, but there was more to it. And that's perfectly fine, too.
Mm. I like the way... I like what you said, Heidi, about the difference between an afterword and a foreword. That if he'd put that at the beginning, then he would have been telling us what to do with it, do with the story. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense in which there's not really any need for a story after that. If what you're doing is preaching a sermon or writing a broadside or writing an editorial, mm-hmm. Why write a novel? Those are two different things.
Yeah,
I like the way. Go ahead, David.
Oh, I was just going to say, and there's, you know, there is that distinction between, am I reading it, like, am I just reading it for the first time, or am I really studying it closely? You know, like when you just read it to your kids for the first time, that's a different thing you're going after, or when you read it for yourself, than it is when you start really trying to do a literary type of reading, right? Would you say that's fair? So then that afterward becomes maybe more useful from a studying, trying to dive deep into it perspective than just that first experience with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. And the, you know, obviously some, I don't want to come across like I'm saying, no books written for social reasons should be considered great literature. That would be a terrible ground to stand
on.
No,
I don't hear you saying that.
Okay. Yeah. I think immediately of Huckleberry Finn, which begins even in the foreword with a statement of didactic purpose, right? That ironic foreword that says anybody trying to find a moral in this book will be shot. I mean, obviously Twain is saying as loud as he can, I am about to unload a moral on you.
Right.
And I'm going to start on page one and I'm going to continue all the way through to the end. So it's not that a novel can't ever be written for a didactic purpose.
I once heard someone say that little note at the beginning was an example of someone being both ironic and ironic at the same time.
Yeah, that's great. I love it. But I will say this, if Ralph Moody had done what Heidi was talking about and put that afterward in the foreword, I might not have read it.
Right.
I might have said, okay, I get what you're trying to say. Now I can save time and having read your sermon, go read somebody else's novel.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So can we compare that to, she asked if we can compare it to Laura Ingalls Wilder. Do you see, I mean, we don't get an afterword in Little House on the Prairie, say. There's lots of sources and letters and other things like that, that you can study her work and get a sense of what she's after. But in just comparing the two works themselves, do they seem like they're after the same thing to you? What do you think, Adam?
That's a good question. I think it's problematic for me because before I read the afterword, what I figured Ralph Moody was after was what I imagine Laura Ingalls Wilder is after, which is a fond reminiscence of childhood where she praises the universal principles that make life worth living in a general way, and tells a great yarn in the process. Mm-hmm. And I think that's my impression of what Wilder is after. And I would like to think that's what the glory of Little Britches is as well. Hmm. But I think the presence of that afterward kind of throws a wrench in it for me. Hmm.
You know, Claire responded to this question and it's not a question that she writes here. Well, she does have a question at the end, but since she posted it publicly on a mostly public page, I'm going to actually share some of her comments here. I hope she's okay with that. But she wrote that in some ways, the afterword ruined the book for her. She says, up until then, I enjoyed it just for being a story about a boy growing up in a different time period than I did. But then the afterword spoiled it. Sure, he had a good childhood, but looking at it from a historical perspective, lots of kids did not. There were still kids working in factories. Native American children were forced from their lands and were horribly treated on reservations. Black children didn't have equal rights. Girls had no opportunities. And in the 50s, when he writes this, people were fighting against social inequality. Black kids literally fighting to be allowed into equal education. Girls trying to be more than wives, teachers, and secretaries. And he has the nerve to say, kids these days, I don't know what their deal is. She says she's paraphrasing there. But it was a bit infuriating to her that he was so flippant. Maybe I'm reading it too much into this, she says, but dang, things needed to change. And it's great he had a good childhood and I enjoyed reading about it. But to say things were better in the good old days, ha, for who? Let me get off my soapbox now, she says. What do you think of that, Heidi? What do you think of what Claire says?
Right. Well, I think that this has been a thread of conversation between the three of us as we've recorded the podcast. This idea of romanticizing or glorifying a past era is, and we talked about some of the potential pitfalls of that and some of the, you know, redemptive potential of that. And I think that this is, That to be honest, is why I liked the afterword, because that kind of gets those exact questions going, which I find those very human and literary questions, which is, now that I know the author's statement of purpose, did it work? Do I agree with the author's statement of purpose? If I don't, as she doesn't, then do I still like the book? And should I then read it differently and understand it differently? Those are the kinds of things I find really interesting and create good discussion, whether it's in a classroom or in a family or even inside my own head. And so I'm not fazed by that when I encounter that in a book. We are not bound to think about a book what the author tells us to think about a book. It needs to be factored in, but we're not bound by that. So we can make our own decisions then on and how we interpret it, as long as it's faithful.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Right. Okay. So yeah, there's that. That's a key stipulation there. But what do you mean bound by? We're not bound. You said it could be part of it, right. But.
Well, what I'm saying is that for a comment like what she makes, then we're not bound to say, well, now the book failed because the author intended me to feel this way and I don't.
Ah, okay. Adam, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that,
Fight.
Well, I mean, I think Heidi's right in a way that if the author wants me to feel this way and I don't, doesn't necessarily mean the book fails, because I think Ralph Moody is doing something political and social with his afterword. And he's doing something profoundly non-literary, I think. And when we go to consider his work as a work of literature, he's confusing the issue a little bit. And it's troubling for me, because I would actually state the case a little differently than Heidi. I would say that we are bound by his, in some ways, by his opinions about his topic, at least as concerns his own novel. There's a sense in which we're bound to say, after we read his afterword, this is what Ralph Moody meant. We're because it is. We have it from his own mouth. What he meant by Little Britches is what he said in his afterword. And so that's something to consider, just to kind of toss into our conversation. We don't have a choice when we come to the question of what did Ralph Moody mean? And there's a sense in which reading all literature, it comes down to answering that question, at least in my view. The main question of reading literature is, what does the author mean? And if what he means is kids today, then I wonder if I can't remember her name, I'm sorry. I wonder if the commenter has a point. Claire. That's why when I was talking earlier, I was saying, yeah, and in the process of making this case that I may or may not think is worthy to make, he alludes to some universal truths along the way, then that's what I would latch on to. So it's a tough one for me. I really wish he hadn't written the afterword, because it binds me in a way, because of my philosophy of reading, that I don't want to be bound.
Well, but he also, so this is interesting. This is really interesting stuff, because in a sense though, doesn't he also, he says more in the book than what he says in the afterword, and not in the sense that in the sense that it's a more holistic vision, it seems. Like he makes like three statements in an afterword, and in the book he's casting a vision for the world, for the universe in a sense, right? And that's where that universality comes into it. And so what he says by nature of offering us these universal things, these universal principles that you're alluding to, is as valid as what he's saying in the afterword that he doesn't say in the afterword, right?
Right. That's what I would have to go to. I would have to go to that his statements in the afterword aren't an exhaustive list of the things he was thinking when he wrote the novel. They're just some of the things he was thinking.
Yeah, and one of the things I was thinking about, or wondering, I guess, is, did he write this afterword because, you know, the book's out for 20 years or 10 years or something, and the conversation around the afterword wasn't, he was like, it's not quite where I want it to be. So if I write this, I can shape the conversation around it a little bit. Like, I'd love to know when he wrote the after. I mean, like I said, I was just wondering.
Speculative.
I don't actually know that. So maybe I just should stop talking. But I was just wondering if perhaps there's a, you know, if what part of what he's doing there is shaping conversation or pointing us towards one specific part of the book. But as you said, it's not necessarily exhaustive or comprehensive of the things that he's saying in the book. No, in some ways, I mean, he wouldn't have written the book if he could write everything, as you said earlier, if he could just write an essay that was comprehensively covering everything that the book covered.
Right. But there's another implication of that, which is that if he has to come around and write an essay 20 years later or an afterword 20 years later, however long it was, to make it more clear what he meant, then that's a sign that he didn't do quite as well as he could have done the first time.
Theoretically, though, couldn't it also be a sign that perhaps the generation, that the readers didn't have the ears to hear what he was trying to say? Theoretically speaking?
Sure.
I suppose.
Well, anyway, that shut down the conversation. So we'd have to get into that a little bit more. But Ilya asks, well, she says she would love to hear more about what you were saying about this and the works of Wendell Berry. And she says, I mean, we've just been talking about this a little bit, but do both glorify the old world in similar ways? Do you consider either of them, the canon of Berry and the works of Ralph Moody, to be sentimental or idealistic? Why or why not? Do they have different objectives? So on the one hand, do either of you think that what Moody is doing here and then what Wendell Berry is doing is glorifying this old world? Is that how you would put it?
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
I think that's true. I think that what Ralph Moody is doing, because this is a children's book, I think he's doing something a little simpler than what Wendell Berry's trying to get at, which is a more comprehensive kind of vision or philosophy of the world and of our nation and of humanity and the land. Like Wendell Berry's trying to kind of he's a profoundly conservative vision of the world in the true sense of conservative, of preserving and conserving what is good in a culture. And Ralph Moody is, although he might certainly agree with that, this particular book has a narrower aim to it. And so the question of whether or not they each succeed is a larger question, but just in terms of that kind of vision or goal, Ralph Moody seems to have pretty clearly stated he's talking about this old-fashioned pioneer kind of hardworking family culture childhood.
Would you consider this book sentimental?
I do. Yes.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I think it's sentimental. And I don't know if I would call that a mark against it necessarily.
Right.
I think that's one of the reasons I liked it. You know, I loved it. The warmth and the longing that he expressed, even in his plain, straightforward language, for his father and the relationship they had before his father died, and the rose-colored glasses that everything, you know, that he viewed everything through. I loved it. But yeah, I definitely think it's sentimental.
Heidi, do you think, would you consider Wendell Berry sentimental?
Then I don't like that question at all. do I consider Wendell Berry sentimental? No.
Wait, normally you say things are a good question.
Yeah, I know. I didn't say that wasn't a good question. I said I didn't like it. Those are two different things. I don't think Wendell Berry is sentimental. I don't. But I think he is often interpreted as sentimental and kind of he's misinterpreted as sentimental. And I think that is one of the risks of reading Wendell Berry if you're not a close reader.
Huh.
So are you saying that anybody who reads him as sentimental is not close reading?
Razor, David. No, because I don't think there's anything profoundly flawed about a sentimental reading. And the danger of a sentimental reading is that you miss nuances and that it becomes something you can't possibly achieve. Like, nobody lives this sentimental life. And so that's I think that's a risk in it. But lots of people read Wendell Berry just for the, you know, the sweet story of Hannah Coulter's marriage or whatever. Like that's, and there's nothing wrong with that, but there's so much more there. And I think with Ralph Moody, because he's writing a children's book, and I keep hammering on that, that there is not the same kind of pressure there's as to make it transcend sentimentalism. Like, I don't mind it in the book.
Right. I agree with you. It's a kid's story about a childhood written for kids. Mm-hmm. And so if sentimental can't be applied to every book in that category, then there's something the matter with the world. Mm. I think Barry's work is in a completely different category. When he, instead of sentiment, what he's doing is talking about the human condition and questioning whether progress is an antidote. Mm. That's not sentimental. That's there's something about Barry that's profoundly concerned with the present, even mm-hmm. as he looks back into the past. And he's doing that as almost an excuse for critiquing the present.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that I've never read Barry as sentimental. In fact, I read him as quite cynical. And I mean, I think I would call him a hopeful cynic. But, you know, that might be that I've sat and talked with him, you know, so that kind of colors it a little bit, but that's a different conversation for a different day. Okay. Let's shift gears a little bit. Did Ralph's father, this is from Gabriel, did Ralph's father understand how sick and close to death he was, do you think? It certainly seems that would affect how much, quote, man training, end quote, he gave Ralph at such a young age. Is this book a reflection on Ralph's success at learning how to be a man, or rather a reflection on the father's triumph succeeding at raising his son before his own untimely death? Okay, so do you guys think Ralph's father understood how sick and close to death he was? Adam, what would you say? What do you think the book is?
I don't think we get that. I don't think we get a window into that in the text of the story, because it's told from Ralph's perspective through his 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old eyes, and so I don't think we have that information, so we can't speculate. It's not the story of Ralph's father; it's the story of Ralph. Mm-hmm. And if Ralph's father were the narrator, or if the narrator were looking through his eyes, that would be one thing. But I don't think we have that info, so we can't go there.
What does the book seem like a reflection on Ralph's success at learning how to be a man, or the father's triumph? Can those be distinguished?
Well, you sure do respect and admire and feel a sense of triumph for the father. When Ralph, finally becomes a man there at the end, you do, the thought does cross your mind. Nice job, man. You got it done. Cause he's, you know, you get a sense that Ralph is going to turn out great. But I think in terms structurally, the story is about Ralph. It's about Ralph's development, not his father's project, I would say.
Do you feel, Heidi, do you think we're meant to feel more pride in, I think maybe this is what the question is getting at. Are we meant to feel more pride in what Ralph has ultimately accomplished in his journey, or more of the hat tip to the father? I mean, I guess he just kind of answered that, but what do you think?
I think that's an open question. I'm not trying to dodge the question, but I'm a bit unwilling to pick a lane on that. I think that's embedded within the complexity of the story, is that the kind of the threads that are tying these two generations together, that this is a joint, you know, Ralph's manhood and his character, his integrity, his virtue is a project that has been invested in by multiple people. By mother, by father, by himself, by the other men in his life, by the land itself, by the horses, right? So I do agree with Adam that the focus is on Ralph, but I think the hero of the story, so to speak, is father. So, and we've talked a lot about how Ralph idealizes his father, because there's not really, and I know there's some pushback on that on the Facebook group, kind of that, how we call them flat or whatever. But I still would stand by that because there's not a flaw in Father. So there's what we see of him is still the great man through the young man's eyes, through his son, through the eyes of a child. The vision of memory that we have of Ralph's father is the way that an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old boy would feel about a really good man who was his father.
And who died when he was young.
Yes, exactly.
You know, the mother was around, and so as he was, right. You know, later on, you can read further books and
yeah, the transition to
a mutual colored the way he remembers.
Yes, that transition to a mutual relationship is that's been shortchanged. That's the great grief of this story, right? That he doesn't get to know his father as a peer. He is always going to be father, the father in this book. And so I do think that there's that element of idealization, which again, this is a children's book. That's not bad. Like this is that's not an attack on the book. That's part of the glory of the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next question. I mean, these Q&A episodes are always a little bit jumping around a little bit, but this is from a little bit jumping around a little bit. That was good. Good speaking there. You know, just wanted to emphasize the little bit part. Autumn asks, can you talk about the role of memory as guide? She says, repetition of certain phrases seemed important, and the word ritual was used several times throughout the book. Ralph often calls to mind snippets of mother's poetry recitations when we see him struggling to make decisions, and father comments about how Mame, quote, remembers them all, end quote, which makes her proud. That's in chapter 30. Remembers all of the passages. So the role of memory as guide in this book. Adam, what do you think about this question? Not about the question. How would you answer it, I suppose, is the better thing.
Well, I think that's interesting. I think that the fact that the whole book is a memory is probably even more significant. I don't know. I don't think I would give Ralph Moody, the author, I don't think I would give him credit for carrying on a novel length discussion of memory as a concept. I think what he's doing instead is remembering. Uh-huh. And I think that's a slightly different thing. He's instead of discussing it, he's doing it. Mm. And I think we participate in it vicariously. And maybe that's where the significance lies in us following his lead and going back into our own memories and finding what we find there. Maybe that's one of the uses to which this story can be put.
It does bring up though, the thought that his memories must have of his father, for example, must have shaped him pretty dramatically after the book was over, like after the point that this book, so we don't get that in the book, but it certainly seems that, you know, from the moment when he says that prayer till the moment he writes the book, those memories would inform not just the telling, but the person he became. And so the way he thought about his father and those experiences mm-hmm. would determine the kind of person he became just as much sure. as maybe the kind of person his father actually was, given how young he was when he died. I mean, I'm kind of just some mm-hmm. gray area in what I'm saying there, but what do you make of the idea of ritual being in this book as much as it is?
Right. I think that that's a very big deal. The book, and we've talked about this over the course of the podcast, the book is written almost like a series of anecdotes or episodes, but the family rituals are embedded within, right? They are kind of this thread, the family dinner, the gathering together, the way they share a meal. The book opens with kind of disrupted ritual because they're moving and focuses on the stress of that. That they're living in a hotel room and mother just can't handle it, right? Because she wants to be home where she could gather her family around the table and go back to this idea of ritual and the liturgies of an ordinary life and how formative they are. They seem very intentional. The parents seem very intentional about that. They understand that. They're building their family upon that. And then the story ends with a ritual, them gathering around the table and her passing the baton onto Ralph as the man of the family. So it is very clear throughout the story that in spite of the episodic structure of the novel, it is the rituals of the family are this guiding principle and moral guide to the children of the family.
Okay, next question. Got time for a few more here. Amy's asks, I continue to think about the conversation around, quote, reporting the facts versus, quote, reflecting truth, to put it simplistically. That's her point. That's her commenting on her own question. I agree with your consensus, Amy says, that a story, even a memoir, can be true while not exactly presenting every episode factually. Heidi's example of the James Frey book was an interesting recent example, though my memory of that one is that he made up stories from whole cloth. I do wonder at what point this might be a problem for the reader in trusting the author. In your opinion, where does this line fall and how is the reader to discern? Adam, what do you think about this? And I ask you in part because of how much you are, how much you emphasize what an author says about his work. And so, not that we don't, but you just particularly.
Shut up. That's
all. I didn't say that. So she says, I wonder at what point this might be a problem for the reader in trusting the author. So this concept we talked about reporting the facts versus reflecting truth. So is this ever a problem for you? How do you deal with this? How do you approach that when you have questions about how much you're supposed to trust the author?
When he puts in an afterword like Ralph Moody did, that's when I have trouble with it.
Yeah,
because basically what he's doing is he's inserting himself as the subject of the autobiography, mm-hmm. and saying I'm trying to make a point and using my own history to make it. That seems like there's a burden that immediately emerges on him to be telling the truth in a factual way.
Yeah. So at that point, you're saying, well, I have to just take your word for everything that you're saying here.
Right. Whereas Mark Twain in Huckleberry Finn, writing for a social political purpose, is writing a fiction. Mm-hmm. And he never said he was Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer or anybody else. He made them all up. It's a work of literature. I think there's a big difference there. The question was when does the author's factuality create a problem? And I think maybe one case in which it does is when he is the case
we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this: had he not put that afterword in there, would you have felt like it would put less of a burden on him to spell everything out exactly how it was?
Absolutely.
So because he puts that there, it needs to be more precisely true to real life.
I think so. I mean, yeah. I think I mentioned The Great Brain by John Fitzgerald. Those books a time or two ago. Wonderful stories about, obviously had origins in his own childhood, and half the stuff in there was fanciful. You know, it was, and you read it and you understand it was fanciful. And he's taken the kernel of his own life, which someone said to him one day, "Hey, you should write a story. That's really cool." And he said, "Okay," and he did, and it was half true and half a work of fiction. And nobody has the slightest bit of problem with that. And I don't think his reliability suffers because of knowing that he embellished a tale for the sake of his art.
I just lost my question. I just lost my phone.
I don't know if that directly answers the question, but I think in the case we're looking at, in the presence of that afterward, I think there is an issue there.
Heidi, what about you? I mean, so do you think that, so there's this burden of him to tell exactly the truth, like make it a very true memoir versus this idea of how does she put it? Reflecting truth. So does this afterward push him? Is he forcing himself into the box to tell things exactly how they are, in your opinion? Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I think author intent is a interpretive tool. I don't think it's the interpretive tool. I think the work itself is the interpretive tool. And so I'm not fazed by that. I think what James Frey did was tell a good story, and that's what a novel is. I think that what Ralph Moody did was tell a great story. That's what a novel is. So that
if Frey puts the word memoir on it, mm-hmm. there is an implication that there's fact there. But then it makes
James Frey a liar. It doesn't impact the quality of his work. So that is so.
So the work can still be valuable, even if it's a lie.
Yeah, and probably better than if, like, I know some of the things he lied about. He puts a girl into the story who he claims was a good friend of his who died in high school, and he claims that that contributed to his addiction. But what he didn't even know her. That actually happened, but he didn't know the girl. But if he had written that into his story, it would have been a worse story. So it makes him a liar. That's true. But the story is good. Now, whether he should have called it a memoir or a novel, that goes to his integrity, not the integrity of the work itself. So I'm not trying to dissociate, but in this particular story, I think what he's doing is, I do agree that if you claim to tell the truth, you should tell the truth. So I think that's true. About
so morally, yes. you should say you're good.
You should definitely tell the truth.
Adam, do you want to go after her new critic tendencies?
Go for it. Yeah.
I have a friend whom I encourage.
Wait, is it going to be me?
No. I had a friend whom I encouraged to read Jaber Crow by Wendell Berry. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of characters in Jaber Crow that I think you really would identify with, and the principles that Jaber tries to live by, and the principles that inform the little town that Berry describes would really resonate with him. And he read it halfway through, and got so excited about Port William, the town that the story takes place in, that he went on Google Earth and tried to find it. Mm. And of course, it doesn't exist, right? Because though Jaber Crow is a memoir, it's entirely fictional. Mm-hmm. There's nobody, never ever was anyone named Jaber Crow, and Port William is an invention of Wendell Berry's imagination. My friend was so offended when he found out that there's no such thing as Port William that he put the book down and never went back to it. Huh. I said, I can't imagine what a lie was foisted upon me.
So even though it's roughly, I mean, there is Port Washington, and that's the town that Barry's, you know, address is in. It's this small town. And so, I mean, so even though it was loosely based on experiences, you know, that reflection of truth, that still bothered him.
Yeah, because he was looking for a memoir. He thought it was a memoir. Huh. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is there is a certain, when we put memoir on the cover, there is a certain, it's a certain genre,
right?
And we expect a level of factual accuracy,
right,
that we don't expect when it says novel on the front.
But to go to her question, which is, it's a really good question. But when she says, what does that mean for something along the lines of trusting the author? And so I think we like Aristotle go to like trusting the author for what, right? Let's define our terms. Are we trusting the author to be to tell a good story? What are we trusting the author for? And so that goes to what you were just saying, Adam, that if you claim something to be a memoir and you say it's factually true, that maybe don't do that if you're writing a story that's a little bit fictionalized. But there's, I don't think an author is under an obligation to write a story that is factually true. I think that a story by definition is something other than history.
Absolutely.
It's a form that is, it's very important that form is true to itself and is what it is. It is a story. And so if that's what we're talking about trusting an author for, then let's find out what a story is. And then let's approach a story like that.
Until the author says, these are the details of my life, and I think everybody in the 1950s should live like I lived.
Right. Well, and your point about that afterwards. He basically
opens himself up to, you didn't tell the truth.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Sending an investigative reporter out there to discredit him and say that. Yeah. Right. Yep.
Yeah. Well, maybe we need to send someone out there. You're not far, Heidi. Christy asks, or Christy says, I'm not sure if you've recorded yet. We had not, but I'd like to hear about how the Western genre seems to be the pinnacle, so to speak, of independent masculinity, toughness, etc., while also offering this mentorship role in many of its characters. I find it interesting that the genre values tradition in this way, though it's happening in a setting that's wild and uncivilized. These are just some of the thoughts off the top of my head.
I like that question.
I don't know, but there's no question here. Should we move on?
She would like to hear thoughts about it.
She'd like to hear us. She just wants to hear us talk about that. We can talk about it.
Right? That's a great question. And I think you should talk about that, David.
Adam, my thoughts are that you should talk about this. Because today I'm a moderator. That just jumps in when I want to. So the Western genre being the pinnacle, so to speak, of independent masculinity, toughness, etc., while also offering this mentorship role in many of its characters. Do you have thoughts on this, Adam?
Well, I think something that we talked about before, maybe early on in our discussion of Little Britches, is the idea that the whole romance of the Western genre, and indeed of that period of American history or that facet of American culture, is the tension between the wilderness and civilization, and the problem of establishing civilization in the wilderness. And three, I think three things are really critical to that process. And the one is the individualism and rugged masculinity, if you want to call it, that's necessary to forge out into the wilderness, the courage that it takes and the self-reliance that it takes to do that. And then secondly, the respect for and longing for the traditions that you're there to establish. Those are going to be the things that are the bulwark against the encroaching wilderness. So those two things go together in the Western genre, I think. Rugged, individual, self-reliant man who is there for the purpose of establishing honored traditions and bringing civilization into the wilderness. And I think that mentorship kind of grows naturally out of that project as people age and have children and bring people along into the project. But the whole project itself that embodies the American move westward and establishing the civilization from sea to shining sea, I think involves those elements necessarily. So I think that's what makes a Western great.
There's a common, I don't know if I would say it's a, I guess it's a common trope in Western stories, including movies. You see it in Shane, for example, you see it in The Searchers, where you have this sort of individualistic, to use her word, rugged hero type character, or a character that seems like he or she is supposed to be a hero, usually a man. And then you have somewhere in the middle, in the midst of the story, a young person who is sort of this person might be the character who has to be rescued, as in The Searchers or in many other stories. It might be the young person who wants to be like this rugged individualistic character, as in Shane, and many other stories. Sometimes that character is often it's a boy who is sort of trying to grow up, much like in this story. But that sort of that character often seems to be caught between the two poles. It seems in a sense that character is being brought, that sort of individualistic character is forced out of his own individualism to interact with this young person.
Yep.
In Shane, you have to teach this lesson. In this book, High comes back. This is in many ways not a sort of archetypal Western story, the one we're talking about, Little Britches. In The Searchers, John Wayne's character, Ethan Edwards, he is this very, he's a marshal turned outlaw turned marshal type character, And he has to let go of his normal perspectives and go rescue his niece. So oftentimes it's this character who is pulling against the instincts of this individualistic character. And oftentimes the implication being that those individualistic instincts of that character are sort of a failing for them in some ways. And so that tension is often at the heart of many of these stories, because the question is what there is in the course of moving across this wilderness and supposedly trying to bring civilization to it, is their individualism actually a virtue? Is one of the key questions in the richest Western stories, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You might get the more like just sort of basic versions of these genre stories. And in those cases, maybe that's not the case. It's just sort of like in their individualism, their rugged individualism, so to speak, is held up to be a virtue. But I think the most profound versions of this kind of genre is, or examples in this genre, is when that individualism is challenged, and the question of whether that's a virtue becomes really true to the heart of the story. I mean, The Lonesome Dove is one of the great examples of this, by the way. And so is the works of A.B. Guthrie. But I think that that's the greatest Western stories are the ones that say, that ask, you know, the virtues that we ostensibly attribute to, like being a great cowboy or a great explorer or something, are those virtues that can be sustained when you are bringing civilization, or which can sustain civilization? That's why I think that at the end of it, the cowboy almost always has to leave, because the virtues of that character that make that character who he is are not necessarily the same virtues that sustain the community that he is trying to preserve or protect or help establish.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's necessary in stage one of the taming of the wilderness.
And sometimes he has to come back and kick someone out.
Right. But stage two happens without him.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where I think, like, you know, I think reading on in this series is really interesting, because I think it does explore that a little bit. Okay, well, do we have time for one more?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Krista. She asks, what if they hadn't moved? The father would, I'm sure, still have died at a relatively similar age. You know, that's one of the reasons that they moved in the first place. And ultimately, you know, one of the sad things about the story is this whole adventure that the family was after, you know, it didn't work. So then Krista asks, would Ralph still have learned, quote, how to be a man in much of the same ways as he did while they were in Colorado? I don't mean for this, she says, to be an urban versus rural debate. So maybe a clarification would be to ask if the difficulties of ranching made Ralph into a different man than he would have been had they stayed in New England. And Susan mentions that this does get explored perhaps a little bit in future books. But what do you think about this? Do you think it made him a different kind of man? And could he have still grown up? I mean, do you think he still would have grown up to be a man? And I'm curious what you think of this question in relation specifically to that afterword that he puts out there. Yeah, Adam, what do you think about that?
It sounds like he's one of the purposes of this story is to extol the virtues of the West and the kinds of manhood that spring maybe uniquely from, you know, cattle ranching and cow poking and tornado watching and that sort of stuff. So I think maybe he became the right kind of man in Ralph Moody's estimation.
Heidi?
I agree. I think that while you were talking and when I read that online, I thought the afterword, there's no way for us to know that, the answer to that question, obviously, but the afterword specifically says, I want to extol the virtues of the pioneer childhood, that the liminal space, that the rugged wilderness and growing up there. Now, on the other hand, though, having spoken about the family rituals, the strong character of mother and father, that would have been the same no matter what their context. And so there's certainly no way to tell whether or not Ralph Moody would have wanted to write the same kind of book about a life well spent in a happy childhood in New England. So the nature of the family was very likely to have been the same. And that's how a lot of us are raising our kids, right? In the suburbs or in the whatever. And I know she doesn't want to go into the rural versus the country, but part of what he is extolling is also just the idea of a strong family culture.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So what if they never did move? What if it was all happened in Massachusetts or wherever it was, but then he decided to set it in the West?
You couldn't very well call it a memoir then, could you?
So many layers of this onion.
Elizabeth comments, I know this is, well, I guess she does ask a question, but she says, do you think the scene where father is hit by the horseless carriage is how it happened, or could it be a metaphor of the carelessness of modernity colliding with the path of tradition, of hard work, integrity, and respect that Moody addresses in his afterword? Hmm. She just posted this 2 minutes ago, so... Right.
to that, I would say that if this was Wendell Berry writing this, maybe.
Right.
But I, what Heidi's been saying all along, I think, is really to the point there. This is a kid's story. Mm-hmm. Written, frankly, by a kid's story author.
Right.
I think that might be giving him too much credit.
Right. Well, I mean,
I don't want to speak bad of the dead.
Fitzgerald.
Right? Yeah, those are some words to drop in the last minute of the series. All right. Well, speaking of which, Heidi, I know you need to go. So I'm going to let you offer some final thoughts on this book, and then I'll let Adam comment, and then we'll sign off and get ready for next week. So, what do you, final thoughts, Little Britches, Ralph Moody's Little Britches?
Sure.
Your final word on this book.
Yes. Well, I think I would just, I would say that there is a lot of literary conversation to be had about this book. It's very well written. It's very well crafted. There's a lot going on in this book, but there's nothing wrong with just reading it aloud to your kids and enjoying it for what it is. And so I look forward to reading it. I've never read this one before. I look forward to reading through the rest of the series. But when I read it to my kids, which I haven't done, I'm just going to read it and just enjoy it for the story. And but thanks for the opportunity to discuss it on a more literary level. I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Now go do the thing you have to do, which is a secret and we can't talk about publicly until you put a picture on Instagram.
Okay, I won't. Yes. So I am going to say what it is though, because this isn't going up until it's done. So my husband's turning 40 tomorrow, and the kids and I bought him a puppy. So we've got to go. I know. And it's such a bad idea. I'm like freaking out about it today.
That is a bad idea.
Why am I buying a puppy?
But it's his dog, so he'll take care of it.
No, he won't. I am going to take care of this dog. And he will. He's great. But it's such a bad idea to get a puppy. And so we're all so excited, and it's going to be really adorable, but I'm supposed to pick it up in half an hour. So I gotta go do the thing. So yeah,
go make bad decisions.
Pray for me.
Good luck, Heidi.
All right. Thanks, y'all. Thanks.
All right, Adam, final thoughts on Little Britches.
I think Little Britches is a great example of a genre that's got a ton to recommend it. I mean, we've talked about all along. It belongs in the same category as Little House on the Prairie. I've mentioned the Fitzgerald books, The Great Brain. There's a bunch of other ones in that general classification. And this is a shining example of it. I think it does all of the things that the best titles in that genre do, and it does them all well. And I think what Heidi said is really good. Just to read it with your kids as a for what it is, I think she said, which is, as I would say, a great example of this genre. But there's also one way that it's useful even beyond that. And that is as a type, an early type of the memoir, of the fond reminiscence that actually has a deeply thematic purpose. And I think reading this to prepare students to think about and read books like Huckleberry Finn, books like To Kill a Mockingbird, the novels of Wendell Berry later on. I think to see it in a progression that ends with those more mature works might be a useful way to go as well. So you could get the most out of it without pushing it beyond what it's really built for. Mm.
I do have a question for you. Do you think, how much do you think you would talk, like say you're talking about the books with your kids, they ask questions or whatever. How much do you think you would talk about what he tried to say in the afterword with the kids? Like at what point would you do that with your kids? Or do you think that the book will teach them the lessons that he's trying to get? The kids will pick up on that even if you don't tell them what he meant to do.
A great question. Thank you for asking it. You're giving me a soapbox here at the end, aren't you?
I am. I mean, that's kind of the point of the final thoughts, right?
I would say that if he hasn't said it well enough in his novel so that it needs an afterword, then we should read his novel and notice the deficiency. Hmm. I think a novelist who is trying to do something in his novel, we judge the novel based on how well he does that in between the front cover and the back cover. Because the novel is, as I think Heidi mentioned, it's a work of art that has its own rules and has its own structure. Hmm. And the best novels are the ones that accomplish what the author set out to do all by themselves. Hmm. And I think what I would do is, as I would read this novel and I would have a discussion with my kids about what the novel says and what the author seems to be saying. and interact with it as a work on its own and try and let it stand on its own feet.
So let me ask you a follow-up to that then. If you're talking about, you know, say this book with your kids, and you're kind of talking about, you know, like, what do you think he's trying to do here? What do you think he's trying to say? And you're going to get varying degrees of perception from child to child at varying ages and all that sort of thing, of course. But if your children are consistently sort of perceiving or getting, saying the opposite or something different than what Ralph Moody is trying to say, do you think that that then indicates that do you look at that as something wrong with your children? Do you look at that as something wrong with the book? Do you look at that as something do you need to go out and fix their understanding of it, given that he said something very specific? Or is it okay for them at this point to just sort of, you know, let's do this one step at a time, and maybe they're getting the wrong thing right now, but, you know, later on they might get something different, or they, you know, the more you read books, the more they'll become more perceptive. How would you deal with them not getting what he's trying to ask them to get?
Yeah, that's another great question. I mean, I think teaching generally, and maybe teaching literature in particular, is an exercise in, over the long haul, inculcating the right kinds of intellectual habits. Mm-hmm. And it's over the long haul teaching students to ask the right questions and follow them faithfully where they lead. Mm-hmm. And so you're asking questions in a work of literature about who the protagonist is, what are his goals, what are the obstacles that he faces, what's the turning point of the action that determines whether he's going to get what he's after. Yeah, you teach him to ask all those kinds of structural questions that lead to thematic answers. And I think over the long haul, students with a lot of experience in asking those questions tend to read carefully, and they tend to arrive at answers that the author was shooting at more often than not. Hmm. And so I would actually not worry too much in the early stages about whether kids are getting the quote unquote right answers. I would worry much more about whether they were learning to ask the right questions.
Well, I suspect that's in some ways that's freeing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a lot less anxiety inducing.
Yeah. Yeah, literature is a lot different than math, it turns out. it's an aid to general contemplation. Hmm. Maybe math is too. I just don't understand it well enough. There are fewer right answers in literature, it seems to me.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking the last several weeks to talk about this with us. We have discussed some possible future books over the next, you know, the next while that we'll need to have you back for, and we're going to have those conversations some more. But thank you for taking the time to be here, and little close reads and bibliophiles crossover.
You betcha, man. My pleasure. Oh. I appreciate it, David. Thanks for the opportunity to be with you. It's always a pleasure.
I know we've gotten great feedback every time you've come on. So, you know, we'll have to keep having you on. You seem like you do okay.
Anytime, my friend.
Well, thanks to Classical Academic Press and Classical U for sponsoring. Remember, you can go over to classicalu.com/code and then use code CerseiPodcast to get free access to Classical U through June 29th. And again, the code is CerseiPodcast and the URL is classicalu.com/code. Thanks to Heidi. Thanks to Adam Andrews. This was a great conversation. Thanks to everyone who participated, sent in questions, commented on the Facebook and Instagram pages. It's been great, as always, talking about this book with you. Don't forget, next week we are starting Sense and Sensibility with special guest Karen Swallow Pryor. We will post a schedule for that on the Facebook book group, on Instagram, and also we'll send out an email next week with the schedule and some other information about this book. So be on the lookout for that. All right, with that, thanks for listening. Happy reading, and we will talk to you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.